This is Cry Justice with Judy Redlich, examining issues of importance to you, your family, and our community that the other media just won't cover. Now, here's Judy Redlich.
I'm Judy Redlich. Thanks a lot for tuning in to today's edition of Cry Justice. We've been focusing on the death penalty a lot recently. There's a great move, not only in the state of Missouri and Illinois, but across the nation, and some new things are happening concerning the death penalty. I have with me Bruce Calkins, who is the editor for the Cry Justice Journal newspaper. We're going to talk with him a little bit about the newspaper and why it exists, what its purposes are. And then we're going to take a look at some of the death penalty cases and death penalty rulings that have been taking place recently to give you some insights into what's really happening behind the scenes and behind the bars. Welcome, Bruce.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here. We have quite a number of things going on here in our Cry Justice office. As your listeners are probably aware, we've had several moves recently that show a very positive trend toward abolition of the death penalty, not only here in Missouri, but in several states as well, and with the Lord's blessing, maybe even nationally.
That's pretty neat. I know that Joseph Amrine was just exonerated, which is pretty exciting, after being on death row for 17 years.
Yes, he was. In fact, with your okay, I have something I'd like to read concerning Amrine.
Wonderful.
Okay, this is from the National Coalition Against the Death Penalty, which I'm sure you're aware is the benchmark organization that's been working very hard against the death penalty nationwide. They write, and this is a recent article, they say, more innocent people walk off death row as new cases break in Missouri, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. It said, with the release of Joseph Amrine of Missouri from prison, at least 111 people now have been freed from death row due to actual innocence. More evidence that the death penalty is an egregiously flawed and erroneous public policy. They write further, Amrine was released after having been convicted of a 1986 murder of a prison guard. Witnesses who testified against him later recanted their testimony and admitted they were seeking reductions in their sentences in exchange for false testimony. Gary Lamar James of Ohio was released from prison after new evidence proved he was innocent of a murder that occurred in 1976. It says James and an alleged accomplice, Timothy Howard, spent some 26 years in prison after they were convicted of killing a bank guard who was shot during a robbery. Both men were sent to death row. However, their sentences were commuted after Ohio's existing death penalty statute was ruled unconstitutional.
Really? So Mr. Howard's sentence was also commuted?
Yes, it was. It said Howard was released in April and became at least the 109th death row exoneree. James is number 110. Mm-hmm. Franklin County Prosecutor, which is in Ohio, Ron O'Brien, acknowledged the two men's innocence, saying, and I quote, "We don't want nobody in prison serving time for something they didn't do." And then also in another state, it was announced that yet another person soon will gain his freedom from death row in Pennsylvania due to actual innocence. Nicholas James Yeras of Pennsylvania has been on death row since 1983 for the rape and murder of a 32-year-old Pennsylvania woman. He was proven innocent by DNA analysis after testing showed Yeras' DNA did not match physical evidence left on the victim's clothes and under her fingernails. Hmm. It says when Yeras is released, he will become at least the 112th exoneree.
Isn't that amazing? After 20 years, isn't it a blessing that DNA could last that long from the murder, that they could compare it with his DNA now?
Yes, indeed. And even in Missouri, we have several cases pending that we're working on where DNA evidence could prove the inmate's innocence.
Really? Maybe you could talk about some of those people.
Well, I could, except those files are still in the works, and we really don't have any hard evidence yet.
Well, coming up on Cry Justice, we'll take a look at those DNA findings as soon as those files get to a point where they can be investigated and their findings can be reported on.
But I do have a letter that does concern the death penalty, and this is a case, this gentleman is on death row, and this is one that we are working on, and we have written him back, and we're in process of seeing what we can do. Okay, and the letter reads, I am writing to thank you for offering help to me with my case. I have representation, but since my appeals process has now concluded, my only true recourse is if I can get national media attention. I believe that my most important factors are as follows. According to everyone involved in this case, I was not even at the scene when the alleged murders were said to have been committed. My conviction came as a result of the prosecution's questionable tactics and behavior in the courtroom. It says, Neil C. Moss Jr. was just recently the focus of a national study of America's prosecutors, and his behavior was cited as being the example of just how bad this country's DAs can be. He goes on to write, the only other chance I have is if Governor Bob Holden looks at my case and opts for clemency. I believe that for this to happen, I must have many people or voters contact his office and voice their support. It is said that God works through his people, and I only pray that God sees fit to establish the works of our hands and that he blesses our current endeavor. He writes in closing, I wish to again express how truly grateful I am to the Cry Justice Office for all your support and effort on the behalf of those who have nothing or no one and still have faith. Sincerely, Marlon A. Gray, CP99, he's a death row inmate, Potosi, Missouri.
It's interesting because Marlon was one of the ones convicted in the Chain of Rocks Bridge back in 1991.
Yes, that's right.
And it's very interesting because those three young men who were convicted are all African Americans, and Tom Cummins, the cousin of those sisters, was not convicted, and there's a lot to that case. We have done some stuff on Cry Justice about this case. We are awaiting an interview with a couple of the people on there, and we have those in the midst of being scheduled. So you'll hear more about that Chain of Rocks case. It was a very high-profile case in the metro St. Louis area, and we pray that Marlon Gray and Antonio Richardson, by the way, Antonio Richardson, I think, was just recently taken off of death row because of the ruling concerning juveniles that they could not convict a juvenile and put him on death row. So I think that that we have Marlon Gray and we have Reginald. They are still on death row for this 1991 crime that they allegedly did.
Yes, indeed. And you related to the juvenile death penalty. We have a move by the Missouri Supreme Court, which I think your listeners are probably aware of. But we have several cases breaking of juveniles actually having their sentences changed because of this ruling.
Let's talk a little bit about that ruling. That started in March, didn't it, Bruce?
Yes, it did.
Maybe you could give us a fill-in.
This is a Missouri case that we're working on right now in our office concerning a juvenile who was granted life without parole by the Missouri Supreme Court and actually taken off death row. This is a recent case. Your listeners are probably aware of it. It's been in the news quite heavily. And if I could, this is from Missourians to Abolish the Death Penalty and the Associated Press. This is an article we're actually going to be running in our Cry Justice newspaper. It reads, the Missouri Supreme Court has ruled that juveniles should be exempt from the death penalty because a growing national consensus has developed against the execution of juvenile offenders. The move by the High Court gives hope to those who oppose the death penalty that the state may be reconsidering its stand against the death penalty. The state Supreme Court has argued that juveniles should be afforded the same protections under the law as afforded to the mentally retarded. This concerns Christopher Simmons, who was 17 when he was convicted and sentenced to death for killing a Fenton, Missouri woman, Shirley Crook, back in 1993. In 1993, Simmons, like other 17-year-olds too young to vote, sign contracts, make medical decisions, drink alcohol, smoke tobacco, or be on a jury, push Shirley Crook to her death off a Merrimack River bridge, and was ruled and tried as an adult by state officials. The court sentenced him to death. This has later been ruled in a 4-3 decision. The court resentenced Simmons to life in prison without parole, and this happened just last week.
Well, that's pretty exciting, because I know that just before his his pending death, in fact, he was on death row, and he was up for being executed last May or last June. And I know that we did a story with Brian Newbrigge, who was with the Catholic Charities. His youth group had been witnessing to this young man, and they had been praying with him and working with him, and they did a lot of work behind the scenes, and lo and behold, his sentence was stayed. So that's really good news that Christopher is now off death row, because you look at the child. In fact, you know what? I'm going to do this. I'm going to put in a little excerpt right now from the interview that I did with Brian, and you can get a little bit of an insight into who Christopher Simmons really is and what kind of background he came from. Brian, tell us a little bit about Christopher Simmons' case and why you got involved with it.
Well, the crime started out to be a burglary, and the woman, Mr. Shirley Crook, who lived at the house, unbeknownst to Chris thought the house was vacant. So he brought nothing with him, of course, to commit a murder, which I think tends to show a lack of premeditation. He just came to burglarize the house. Shirley Crook was home. Chris panicked, and they tied her up, and they drowned her in the river, in the Merrimack River.
They?
Yes, there was a 15-year-old who was with Chris at the time.
And what happened to him?
Chris, the other young man, received the age of 15, received a sentence of life in prison without possibility of parole.
So he received life in prison without possibility of parole, and
right.
Christopher Simmons received the execution sentence.
That's correct. That's correct.
So here we are. We have a 17-year-old and a 15-year-old, and not premeditated. The burglary might have been premeditated, do you think?
Right. They were planning on committing a burglary and just picked that house to do it.
Why did they pick that house? Did
they were
know the people?
They had been told, I believe, that the house was empty. They were in some ways working for a 28 or 29-year-old convicted felon that would allow teens from the area to hang out at his house. They called themselves like a little gang, the Thundercats, and he called himself the Thunder Dad, and he would send him out on little errands for him. It's never really been proven that this man directed these boys to commit this burglary, but they did meet at his house prior to the burglary, and then they went to the house from there.
Because Shirley Crook was home, they tied her up, threw her body in the river.
Well, they threw her, when they threw her in the river, she was still alive. She drowned in the river. It's painful.
So he's been in prison since 1993. As you talked with him, Chris, and became his friend, and you and your wife became his friend, and the teens wrote to him, how was he taking this? What was his struggle like?
It's best, I think, described with something he just recently told me. He sees himself, and it's a beautiful image, he sees himself like Peter in the storm. He's walking on water. He's keeping his eyes focused on Jesus and on his faith in Christ. And as long as he stays focused on that faith, that God's will overcome, that he is resting with the Lord, then he is going to keep on walking on water. He is going to keep a positive attitude, and he's going to keep his faith. As soon as he starts to see the storm around him, he'll start to sink. So he stays focused on his prayer life and on his relationship with Christ.
That's beautiful. Amazing. That's beautiful. Do you think Peter ever realized how much impact his walking on water would really have from generation to generation and even in the year 2002?
No, and that's what's amazing is even simply in the effort, I think, to stop the execution by talking to people who are moved by this story, are coming to a greater understanding of the death penalty and of the need to really address this issue. The teens that he has touched, it's really amazing. It's beautiful. This is an experience that whether he is executed or not, they will carry with them for the rest of their lives of the compassion and love of Christ, the transforming power, and the power of faith that one person, although looking right at this death sentence, can acknowledge the fact that this death sentence does have power over him, that it is more powerful than he is, but it is not more powerful than Christ. It is not more powerful than the cross. Than the cross. And that is such a beautiful statement. And these teens are having this real powerful experience of, I'm having this real powerful experience of that. Well, I'm saying teens. The people who are connected to this execution are really having this understanding. Who knows what fruit this will bear in the years to come. Well, I got involved because our office was doing an event to educate teens and youth ministers about the death penalty and about scriptural and church teaching on the death penalty. I sent a letter to Chris to let him know we were doing, as a juvenile offender, I thought that would be a good tie-in to the teens that we were trying to reach. He responded with a letter to those teens. I kept correspondence up with him and started going down to see him, and he soon became a good friend of mine and my wife's. When we received his date, of course, it was very painful and very much struck us that now was the time that we needed to do something, so we really stepped up our efforts to try to get letters sent to the governor at that time.
Now, Brian, in his letter to the teens, what were some of the things that he stressed?
Well, what he seems to stress when he talks to young people, in fact, he just did this again on a conference call with some teens in South St. Louis, how important it is that these teens who have a relationship with Jesus Christ and carry his love around in their hearts, how important it is for them to share this with teens around them, especially ones that might seem different or unapproachable, that to share this with them, because teens have an ability to reach other teens that us adults really do not have. And if they would reach out to these teens, who knows what kind of transformation that the Holy Spirit can work in these teens' lives. If someone had been able to reach Chris going through this difficult period of his life leading up to the crime, not only possibly would Chris still have his freedom and have his life, but the Crooks would still have Shirley Crook would still be alive. So it's a very powerful message to teens to go out and reach out to their to the people around them, as well as he can address teens who are in that kind of a difficult situation and in a situation where there might be experimenting with drugs or on a road to crime, and say, look, there are real consequences for your action. I'm living proof. Here I am. I was your age. I was where you are right now. Now I am in prison. The best that I can hope for is life in prison without possibility of parole.
Tell us a little bit about Christopher's background and the story behind the crime.
About the time that he was born, Chris's mother and father divorced, and that always, as I think is well documented, causes stress in a child's life, and that, I think, was the very beginning of the difficulties that Chris would experience growing up. His mother and father did not get along, and he often felt that he was the pawn between the two, vying for his love, using him as a way to attack the other. His stepfather, as he grew up, became abusive and very angry with Chris.
So his mother remarried.
His mother
after
remarried.
They got a divorce.
Right.
And so the visitation was between the father and the mother, and the child was shifted around from place to place to meet the needs of each parent and also to help him with the bonding process, right?
Correct.
And
correct.
Then his mother remarried. How old was Christopher when his mother remarried, approximately?
I don't know that, actually. I don't know that. I think he was very young, but...
She remarried. What happened?
Well, the man that she married turned out to be abusive towards Chris. His extended family had almost termed it like there were, where Chris was the Cinderella type of the group, of the family. Mm. They had other children, and they were seemed to be treated more favorably than Chris. Chris suffered the brunt of anger and abuse coming from his stepfather.
So then what happened as he became a teenager and on?
This quickly turned into, grew into a teenager who didn't have this sense of grounding or a sense of love in his family, and to escape this reality of the abuse, he would often run away from home. He turned to alcohol and drugs, which is so unfortunately so typical in these cases, as an escape from his reality. And in this state, as a young person, our brains, and this is some recent scientific evidence on this, that our brains are still developing, still growing, even much more than we had previously thought. And it's especially in the centers that control judgment and impulsiveness.
When one is an adolescent,
and all the way through the late teens.
Mm-hmm. I know that statistics show that if one begins drinking, say, 14, 15, or 16, he's most likely to become an alcoholic rather
right.
than if he starts drinking later in his 20s. So that
right.
is really true. And also the judgment factors I've seen in statistics, the tolerance for alcohol is much lower for a teen who starts out drinking 14, 15, or 16.
Absolutely. So you've got a combination of the already existing vulnerability of a youth. On top of this, you have the abusive background, the alcohol and drugs, and you have a young person who really is incapable of understanding right from wrong, of making sound judgment, of understanding the consequences of his actions, or even understanding the value of the human person, of the inherent dignity of a life.
Brian Niebrigge is my guest. We're talking about Christopher Simmons. His execution date was set for May the 1st, 2002.
Now, Christopher Simmons was a very lucky young man. Besides the May date, Christopher had a June 5th date as well, but that was also postponed. And then, in March of 2003, legislation was passed that no juveniles could be executed. So, I mean, God has really had a hand on Christopher Simmons' life.
Brian met Christopher through a teen project, for those of you who just joined us, because he wanted to help teens see the reality of what happens in prison and the reality of how a death sentence makes one struggle, not only in prison, but also makes us grapple with the whole factor of, do we have the right to kill someone? Do we have that right to judge who stays and gets a sentence for life and who is executed? Now, let's talk a little bit about those teens. How long have they been involved in this project, and are the same teens still involved?
Absolutely. It started really a little under a year ago. And a friend of mine who is a youth minister took some of his teens on one of these death penalty nights. We call it a John 8 night to reference Jesus' forgiveness of the adulteress. Mm-hmm. And the teens had a powerful experience that night. We kind of walked in the footsteps of an inmate who's approaching his execution.
Now, do you go to the prison, or what do you do?
That night we did. We went to the prison, and we prayed outside of the prison.
So you went to Potosi Correctional Center?
Yes, we did. That was during the execution of Jerome Mallett.
So it was a vigil. It was like a vigil that you had the teens do outside the prison when Jerome Mallett was being executed.
That was the culmination of it. There was a prayer service in St. Louis, a candlelight procession and candlelight vigil outside of the municipal courts, then a bus ride down to the prison and prayer outside of the prison.
Wow.
Powerful experience for the teens. And what they did is they were so moved by the experience and from the contact that they had had with Chris through that, through his letter to them. In their youth room, they had a picture of Chris up that they've had up there for the past year. And their youth minister is a good friend of mine, and I've kept him updated on Chris and how Chris and I's relationship has gone. So my friend Greg has kept the teens updated on how Chris is doing. He's become a part of their life in a way. And now this guy that they've had this picture of, they've come to know of and have some attachment with him, is scheduled to be executed. And it's just a real wake-up call to the reality of the world around them. It takes them out of their little world and engages them in the world at large. I do know that there is nationwide, worldwide, a change in the way we view the execution of juveniles. It's becoming more and more of an issue, and that possibly has something to do with it. The United States in the past decade has executed more juveniles than the rest of the world combined.
Since the ban has been placed on executing juveniles in the state of Missouri, Brian Newbrookie and his wife and young son still visit Christopher. And he still organizes John 8 groups of young people who, on the night of an execution, they do a candlelight vigil outside Potosi Correctional Center in Potosi, Missouri, where executions are taking place. They also pray for a moratorium on the death penalty and that people would value human life more.
Brian, let's go a little farther. What research have you done into the other 49 states? Now, some of those have a moratorium against the death penalty.
Correct.
And some of them have outlawed the death penalty. But of
Correct.
The states that still use the death penalty as a punishment, what are their stances on juvenile executions?
Right now, 16 states and then also the federal government for their crimes have got a minimum age of 18 for capital punishment. Right now, there are 18 states that have the death penalty for people under the age of for people at 16 and over.
People who were convicted of a crime when they were 16 or older.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
That's 18 states, and 16 of those states are for people 18 or older, right?
Right. Correct.
So, what about the other states?
There are states that have a minimum age of 17 as well.
What on a national basis is being done concerning executing someone who committed a crime when he was a juvenile and he was convicted of it?
There are several organizations nationwide, one of those, of course, being the ABA, really large organization, helping to lead the effort against juvenile executions.
And that stands for what?
The American Bar Association.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Amnesty International is another group that is very concerned with juvenile executions in general, juvenile executions in particular. It's really right now a state-by-state kind of effort. There's a genuine sense across the nation that maybe we shouldn't be doing this. Maybe this is a stat that we want to lead the rest of the world in, is the execution of juveniles.
Brian, if people would like to contact you, if they missed that web address or have some other questions for you, how can they reach you?
I can be reached at telephone number 314-633-2500. I could also be reached via email at niebruggeb@archstl.org.
I think we're going to repeat that phone number again. That's 314-633-2500, and
that's right.
Brian Newbrookie. Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about Chris.
Parents, remember, your children are your treasures. They're important. Please help them grow as they should grow. Help them to realize that they are special people, so it'll be less easy for them to get into the trap
Amen.
Of feeling rejected and alone and maybe reaching out to a prurient lifestyle.
This is Cry Justice. I'm Judy Redlich. Email me with your comments to knlc24judy@hearshelpnet.org. Please join me next time.